Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. For today's talker, we're going to take a look at the multi-billion dollar fertility industry.
Because there's a Boston man. He's a lawyer. His name is Ben Seisler. Now, Seisler is featured in a new documentary that's set to air on the Style Channel next week.
And we've got some clips to play for you. And we'll start in the middle of Seisler's story, when he sat down with his friend, Voss Lakis, and said, "I have a secret to tell you, a big secret."
When I was in law school, I was a sperm donor, and I donated anonymously for like 3 years.
Now, that's not entirely unusual. Seisler's tall, he's good-looking, athletic. He donated his sperm at a cryobank in Virginia to help defray his law school bills. At $150 a donation and the guarantee of anonymity, things didn't seem very complicated.
But then, in 2005, things did get complicated. And Seisler himself is the one who complicated them. See, he'd read an article about the Donor Sibling Registry. It's a website that helps children born via sperm or egg donation, helps them find their biological family members.
So Seisler logged on. He put in his donor number, 2149, and then...
I get this message in my inbox that is just like from a parent saying, "Are you really this donor?"
What? This is...
Yeah.
What? Wait, so you got a little Ben?
In so many words, there's a little Ben.
Is it a little dude or a little girl?
And here's where things get really complicated.
Later, I found out there were 20 kids and 25. And to date, I know of around 70 kids.
That's right. You heard that correctly. 70 kids. By Seisler's own estimation, the number may be as high as 140. Now, the situation makes for a watchable reality documentary special. As we mentioned, Style Exposed, Sperm Donor, airs next week on the Style Network.
But what Seisler's story really exposes is the very thorny landscape that's now emerging as a generation of young people, raised on the internet and with Facebook-fueled notions of what should and shouldn't be private, as these donor-conceived young people want information about their biological fathers.
And I think that by meeting Ben, you might understand that maybe you look a little bit like him and maybe you act a little bit like him. I think that there's a lot of him in you that you don't know about.
That's Sharon. She doesn't want her last name used to protect her children's privacy. The Style Channel flew her family to Boston to meet Ben.
They met back in May in Marlboro, and the visit went well. Sharon's daughter didn't even want Seisler to leave at the end of the day. But that doesn't mean that every question has been answered or that it's clear how donor children will handle information about their biological parents as they grow. In one particularly poignant moment in the documentary, Sharon's daughter just demonstrates how confusing the issue can be.
We're not married. Why would you think that we were married?
Because you got the sperm.
How did Mommy get the sperm?
Google.
Google. That's good.
Yeah, Google. But is it any wonder that the little girl thinks that? I mean, it gets right to the heart of the matter and the real issue here. As Ben Seisler's story shows, the fertility business across the United States is a billion-dollar industry that's almost entirely unregulated. So that's why we're focusing on it as today's talker. Should it be more regulated? Should donors be allowed the anonymity they currently enjoy? They're not anonymous in many countries in Europe. Or should there be a limit to how much money donors receive or the numbers of times they donate? And in the internet age, with this free flow of information and ease of access to retail DNA testing services, how much should donor children be allowed to know about their true genetic background? So we want to know what you have to say and what you think, especially if you've donated or you've born children as a result of donations or are a donor child yourself. We're looking at the largely unregulated industry that is American fertility. So give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we've got several guests in with us who have a lot to say about this issue. Let me first introduce you to Liz Coolidge. She is the coordinator of the LGBT Family and Parenting Services and the Alternative Insemination Program at Fenway Health. Liz Coolidge, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us today is Deborah Sparr. She is president of Barnard College and author of The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. Deborah Sparr, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's wonderful to have you both. And Ms. Sparr, if I could just start with you. Let me get right to the heart of the matter, because we introduced this issue through the story of Ben Seisler, who's had 70, maybe even up to 140 biological children through his sperm donation. What is the state of regulation in the industry in the United States? Are there any limits of any kind?
There are very, very few regulations in this industry overall. Actually, the sperm piece of it has more regulation than the other parts, but even in sperm, the regulations are very minimal, and they mostly have to do with very basic health protections, primarily screening sperm for HIV.
So there's an HIV test. Are there any regulations in terms of genetic screening for other potential diseases, or maybe the number of times a person can donate, or the number of families who can receive the results of those donations?
There are some medical requirements which have to do with screening for various forms of genetic disease, although it's arguable how well those are actually implemented, because the sperm banks are generally not, you know, visit often by regulators or things of that sort. But there are no regulations yet on anything having to do with the anonymity of the sperm donors or the number of times they can donate.
And what is your concern when it comes to this lack of regulation?
Well, I think my concern is pretty well captured by the story you told earlier, that it's kind of a big deal for a guy to discover he's the father of 70 children or even 20 or 30 children. And I think it's, you know, it's one thing to donate sperm when you're a young man. It's another thing to discover later in life that you have fathered quite that many children. So I think we owe it to the donors to tell them a little bit more about what they may be getting themselves into. And I think, crucially, the children kind of fall out of this whole equation, that because the fertility industry is really about creating parents, the children who really remain an abstraction at the beginning really get left out here. And you heard a little bit in the clip you played, many kids grow up wanting some sense of their genetic identity. Mm-hmm. Not all will, but some will. And under the current lack of regulatory structures in this country, these kids have basically no way to trace their origins. And it's not just a question of sort of psychologically wanting to know your parentage. It may also be a question of understanding your medical background, particularly as we move further and further down the road towards genetically based medicine. You know, these kids are actually at a disadvantage if they really have no idea about their genetic background.
Interesting. NPR aired a story on this issue this weekend where they featured a young woman who was born as a result of sperm donation, and she has since had children herself. And from what information she's been able to gather about her parentage, she found out that she's in part Ashkenazi Jew, which led her to wonder about all sorts of questions regarding her genetic background and what she may or may not have passed on to her own children. So I can see there's sort of a knock-on effect through the generations. But let me bring Liz Coolidge into this conversation, because you deal with families who very much, you know, are those who want to welcome children into their lives and who use your services. So can you first describe to us who comes into Fenway Health to see you to say, we'd like to use donors for a family?
Yes. Well, we have an alternative insemination program, which we started in 1983 for lesbians and single women who could not get access to sperm at that time. And the women who come today are the same. We are primarily set up for women who are fertile, lesbians and single women. And so we're a little anomaly in the assisted reproductive technology field, because why we do inseminations and get access to sperm for two-parent families, but not when one person is infertile. The social infertility.
Social infertility. Well, let me ask you, though, do the women who come in to see you, do they have a lot of questions about the donors and what information they can or can't get about them?
Well, yes. We start the process of working with our AI program with a 2.5-hour orientation session, and I give information about the kind of levels of information that the banks provide about the donors, and of course women are interested in that, and also the availability, whether the donors are anonymous or ID release, and what that means. ID release.
Oh, I was just going to ask, what does that mean?
ID release or yes donors are donors who have agreed to have their identifying information given to the children born of their sperm when the children are 18 or older. So the children are legal adults when this happens.
And have you found that over time, as we mentioned the donor sibling registry, for example, which exists on the internet that helps connect siblings who know the donor number, for example.
Genetic half-siblings.
Genetic half-siblings. Thank you for the clarification.
Yes.
That's exactly right. Who know the donor number. They may, if they choose to find each other. That's how Ben Seisler, because he put his number out there,
yes,
found the number of children that his sperm ended up helping create. Have you found that's growing, that maybe families come to you and say, eventually, we do know that we're going to want to know more about where the sperm came from?
Well, what I find is that some couples want an ID release donor because they want their child to have the option to learn more about half their genetic background. And some choose anonymous donors because they don't want the possible intrusion into their family of a donor who could be known later in life. And this, of course, stems from a same-sex couple before 1993. There was no co-parent adoption. The one who was did not give birth could not have any legal relationship to the child. That's changed now, but I think that feeling comes from that.
Would you like to? I'm sorry.
I was going to say something
about
the children.
Please go ahead. Please do. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Some children don't seem to have much wish to know about this half of their genetic makeup. Some are quite curious and are interested, and of course they get a lot of the press and the media as I've been seeing it, but I hear from parents that about both. And there was a woman who called me because her daughter had located a genetic half-sibling through DonorSiblingRegistry.com and found that very important and very meaningful. And the mother called wanting to know if there were other children from the same donor, having talked to the sperm bank as well. And so I couldn't, obviously all of our, we're a medical provider, everything's confidential, but I could determine that the bank knew about all the children born through our program. So it is important to some children. It's not important to all the children.
Deborah Spahr, on that note, since this is, at the end of the day, is such a profoundly personal issue, and I'm sure it's a case-by-case basis, who wants to know what, is there any suggestion you have for regulations that could sort of thread that needle?
Yeah, I actually think this one is relatively easy, and a number of countries in Europe have adopted things that I think could pretty easily be adapted to the U.S., and that is you just push everyone into a known donor category. And exactly as your other guest was just describing, it doesn't mean that the kids need to be showered with this information from the moment of their birth, but you just make the information available to them if they choose to access it at the time they turn 18 or 22 or whatever you'd want to set the age at. And then you'd also create the possibility, and this only happens in rare cases, but it does happen, that a donor discovers later in life that he's a carrier for some potentially horrific disease, that in those cases the banks would have the ability and perhaps the requirement to let all the families know. Particularly as we get more and more of a sense of what kinds of diseases are inherited and what kinds of subsequent procreation run the risk of creating kids who can be very sick if they get two sets of mutations.
In my experience in working with the banks, if they do discover some medical information about a donor, they do contact me trying to get in touch with the women who've used that donor?
Well, I think that varies. I think, you know, there's lots of banks, and some of them are better at doing, at providing this kind of information.
Yes.
But, and right now they're not required to do that, so we're kind of depending on people's good sense and good record keeping.
In fact, one of the major banks, California Cryobank, the head of that bank has suggested that maybe the American Association of Tissue Banks and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine could develop guidelines, short of regulation, but guidelines that foster more responsible practices. Deborah Spar, I have one quick question, and then we have tons of callers who have a lot to say about this. I do want to get to them, but is there any concern when you said pushing all donors into the yes category that that could actually reduce the donor pool, that people who might otherwise be great donors would say, I need to maintain my anonymity, so I'm not going to do it?
Yeah, I think it will, and that's what we've seen in some other countries. It does make people a little bit more nervous, but I think that's a trade-off worth making.
All right. We are talking about the fertility industry in the United States, and specifically around the story of a Boston lawyer who was a sperm donor when he was in law school and found that he may now have 70 or more biological children, and what that means for both those children and people who seek donation to help build their own families. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. My guests are Deborah Spar. She's president of Barnard College and author of The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. And I'm also joined by Liz Coolidge. She is coordinator of LGBT Family and Parenting Services and the Alternative Insemination Program at Fenway Health. Let's take a call from John, who is calling from Milton. You're on the air, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just heard the topic on the radio a few minutes ago, and I had to call in because I'm 30 years old, and I found out about 2 or 3 years ago that I'm actually the product of sperm donation. And, ever since I've been, the nagging question as to finding my biological father has just persisted. And the problem that I'm faced with is that since it was done around the early 80s, 79, 80, my impression, it was done pretty much outside of a donor bank. It was done through a private physician affiliated with Harvard University, and I believe the physician handpicked the donor himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's my suspicion. I don't know that for absolute fact, because there's really no documentation. But to the best that my parents have been able to tell me, it was done very much under the paternal guidance of the physician. And I've since tried to track down some of the information, but the hospital, after 8 or 10 years, no longer had records, and the physician, I believe, if he is still alive, is living in Florida and is very, very old.
Well, John, I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me just jump in here and ask you, because this is like the one question that we can't have anyone other than someone who's gone through this answer. But first of all, when you found out, what was your reaction?
Oh, that's a really great question. It was very interesting. In one, it was profound to say the least, but my mom was very frightened that I would have a very adverse reaction, and I had quite the opposite. Throughout my entire life, I had this nagging, although undefined, concern about, who am I and how do I explain myself through my father's side. And there was always kind of a running joke among my kids that, the landscaper's, orphan child or something like that. And we always joked about it, but, there's always that, I couldn't even frame the question because the possibility of knowing that I was, a product of sperm donation never even crossed my mind. So when I did find out, it was a revelation, and all of a sudden everything just kind of clicked.
Mm-hmm.
That was like, oh, that's where I come from. And it's, just as an aside, it's funny, it was all done, it was a Harvard Medical School student, the best that I can tell, and it's funny that I'm actually in medicine. So it's just one of those interesting philosophical questions as well.
And John, it sounds like do you want to know who the original donor was?
Yeah, very much so. And I think the overriding concern, as was just mentioned, is the genetic long term, if they're a carrier for any genetic disorders that might manifest later in life or in my future children, that's the overriding concern. And I think that's quite legitimate. And also, personally, I think it would be quite interesting to see.
John, thank you so much for sharing your story, and thank you for calling. Liz Coolidge, what do you hear in John's story, and is that something that you've had, maybe clients of your own come back years later and say, I'm faced with the situation?
Well, one thing that I think is very important and counsel the women who come to our program is that this should not be a secret. And, of course, with lesbian parents, it's pretty obvious that it doesn't happen by itself. But it's important for parents to tell their children that they are conceived through with donor sperm, that there is a donor, that you don't have to use that language, obviously, with very young children. But the secret can be very damaging in families, and there are ways to talk about this and language to use so that a child grows up knowing this and it's just part of the landscape.
Hmm. Deborah Spar, same question to you. I mean, John seems to actually be quite sanguine about the whole thing. But, you know, are there other cases in which people just feel desperate to find out who their biological parents are?
Well, I think it varies all across the board because people are people and they have different views of this. But I think John is a great example. This doesn't seem to be something that has traumatized him in any way, but he's got legitimate reasons, both just out of curiosity and out of medical interest, to want to know this very basic fact that pretty much everyone else takes for granted.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a piece of information that, you know, I have, I presume you have, and he doesn't. And I think if we have the ability to give him that information, which we do now, it just doesn't seem unfair. It doesn't seem fair at a very basic level to be denying him. And I think, in my mind, what we're seeing now is so much akin to what we saw decades ago with adopted kids. You know, in the earlier parts of this century, everyone in the adoption business believed that the kids were always better off if they didn't know.
Mm.
And yet, as we learned painfully, actually people were better off if they did know, and that various adopted kids would use the information differently, but in general, they were better off having access to that information. I think we're going through exactly the same process now, and it's just taken a generation of Johns to grow up and to begin to voice those demands.
And the number of those of in that generation seems to be growing. And I have to say, in the few cases that I've heard of and have been able to at least, you know, hear interviews with people, the children, we got to give them credit. They're maybe wiser than we think. It doesn't necessarily fundamentally change their relationship with the parents they grew up with, but they feel more empowered when they get that information in some cases. But let's take a call from Danielle, who's calling from Watertown. You're on the air, Danielle.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I was a known egg donor, which is a little different than what you're describing, because I had a previous relationship with a couple that had fertility problems, and so I had an ongoing relationship with their children. And I've thought a lot about this. I'm actually writing a dissertation on it now, and I've been reading a lot about other cultures and how other cultures will use donors and surrogates, and it seems like there's a lot of evidence that having parents meet a surrogate or meet a donor is an important part of their process and can actually be a really good thing, and seems like something that families in this country have been very nervous to do and have tried not to do. And the secrecy you're describing with not even telling their children is another part of that. And I think that's one reason I think it's really important to be more open and transparent about these procedures.
Great. Danielle, thank you so much for your call. I want to get another call in here. Liz is calling from Dedham. You're on the air, Liz.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome. What's your thought today?
I have a daughter who is 17, and she was born of a sperm donor and a known donor. I mean, not a known donor, a yes donor. So someone who said that when she reaches 18, she is able to contact him or find out information about him. And in the meantime, we also found out through the donor sibling registry that she has a genetic half-sibling who's about the same age. And so they actually are together going to try to find their biological father.
Oh, and Liz, is this something that you support? And are you going to assist them in their search?
Yeah, we actually, from the very beginning, we thought we should have a yes donor because we thought she should have the option of knowing the information if she chose to. Mm. And it's interesting because, you know, we've been truthful with her from, you know, from a very young age. And as she grows and as she gets older and able to understand more information, she's asked for more. And never more than she could handle, but what was appropriate for that age. And, you know, just recently she asked to look at the entire medical record. from the donor because it was something that was interesting to her. But I think it's wonderful that she now has a partner in this quest to find the biological donor.
Liz, thank you so much for sharing your story and for calling. Deborah Spahr and Liz Coolidge, at the end of the day, from the best of my understanding, is that in comparison to other countries, there is very little regulation here in the United States. I mean, Liz Coolidge, you work directly with families who are searching for reproductive assistance. Would you like to see more regulation of some kind, or do you think it might actually interfere with what you do?
Well, I think it would probably make it more expensive for the consumers of healthcare, and that's always a concern. But I do think more regulation is needed, and particularly about the number of children born to one donor. Currently, the women who conceive are the ones who are asked to report to the bank that they have conceived and had a child, and many don't. And part of the reason I think we're seeing so many children from one donor has to do with the family limits, as they're called, not being enforced either by the medical providers or by the banks. So that's something that is important to do, is to really trace how many children are born of one donor and limit that number.
Liz, Deborah Spahr, do you see some sort of middle ground short of full-on government regulation of this aspect of healthcare?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this country tends to be very anti-regulation to begin with, so we're never going to have a system like the United Kingdom does, because they tend to regulate everything more than we do. But I think what pretty much all of your callers seem to have agreed upon is just a basic system of information gathering. Mm. You know, some guidelines, some data collection. Most other sectors in this country already do that. And I just don't think it's really all that hard at all to put some basic framework around this.
Deborah Spahr is president of Barnard College and author of The Baby Business, How Money, Science, and Politics Drive the Commerce of Conception. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Liz Coolidge, coordinator of LGBT Family and Parenting Services and the Alternative Insemination Program at Fenway Health, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, please do continue this conversation online at radioboston.org. Up next, we'll hear from jazz saxophonist Joshua Redman about his new project called James Farm. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.